Today is Thursday, February 19th, 2009. This is Life, the Universe, and Everything. Session is Reality in Science Fiction.
Mercenary strip, space station with giant power plants fueled by neutronium, and it's, you know, black box hand wavium. I don't know what goes on in it, I just know what comes out. Okay? And this space station has a hole in it. It is a rotating space station, 6,000 meters in diameter, rotating, and there is a hole, and air is leaking out. And when I illustrated this in Photoshop, I love render clouds and then swirl. That went so fast. I spent hours on the line art and the rest of the coloring, and then the cloud effect took 3 minutes. But I got email from a guy who, his name's Jordan Kerr. He's actually a fairly big name in the worldwide sci-fi fandom community. He builds space elevator components. He's part of this push to get us into space. Really neat guy, incredible science head. Jordan emails me and says, "Mr. Taylor, I'm disappointed. Larry Niven demonstrated to us that you would not get a hurricane, you would get an ice storm, which means instead of it spinning this way to the hole, it would be spinning this way because Coriolis force." And I'm not going to explain the science here. The point is, he was able to swallow the camel, which is the neutronium-powered generators, like that. But he strained the gnat, which is the wind's blowing the wrong way. And that, I think, illustrates where you have to draw the line in space opera. The technology you made up, as long as it behaves according to consistent rules, that's fine. But if it breaks the rules of science that we already understand, you're in big trouble.
I was this close to coming in saying.
By the way, my response to Jordan, if it had been Bob, I just would have called him names. Jordan, I said, the reason it looks that way is that when I did the line art, I didn't think about it, and when I started rendering the clouds, I couldn't get the perspective right for it to look right tipped on its side, and I was kind of under a deadline, and I'll go back and fix it later. I was lying. And he said, "You know what, that's okay, that happens all the time. I'm just glad to know that you've read your Niven." Yeah! That's why I felt so stupid that I missed that.
One of the things that Stan Schmidt, the editor of Analog, which is kind of the hard science fiction magazine, said is that essentially don't tell the reader how things work unless you absolutely have to. That's kind of the black box neutronium thing. As long as you don't have to get into the technical details of how it all works, it's very hard for somebody to say, well, that could never work.
Yeah, they, Farscape had a lot of problems with that, the forums. They said that nobody had any problems with the faster than light, and jumping from place to place without the magical jump drive. But you put in an alien that farts helium.
Helium's a Nobel gas.
All of a sudden, you've got like 4 weeks of.
What, they have fusion powered bellies?
See?
I'll give you an example of one of my pet peeves. And I know that, I'm sure there are people out here that are fans of the Battlestar. There are people out here that are not as big a fan. And I watched about half the first season, and the thing that kept on striking me, you know, good characters, good production values, kind of soap opera storylines, but everything was okay except for they seemed to have absolutely no sense. The writers had no sense of the geography of space where, you know, like suns were and where planets were, where other suns were, and it seems like for the storyline, they just pretend it's like 24. Everything in L.A. is within 20 minutes of everything else. And in Battlestar Galactica, everything is within story distance of everything else. And the new series. Actually, the old series is bad at that, too.
It was horrible at that.
The new series...
Moving at the speed of light.
Yes. That drove me up the wall, and I, as a viewer, could not get into the story because I just couldn't get past this absolute ignorance of contemporary astronomy.
You know what bugged me about that one? They would climb into their seats, they would have a fire pot set, and they pull the lid down, and they would just sit on the edge. There's no seal, nothing, just pull it down.
Space
has air.
You know that.
That's how you can hear the sound effects at the engines.
Well, the original Battlestar miniseries, you couldn't hear the engines unless you were in the ship. You couldn't hear the explosions in space. I really love those slow nods to the I just figured it out since I was forced.
I think part of it is it matters who your audience is. If you're writing something that's going to go to the tech crowd that thinks of those kind of things, you're going to get those kinds of emails about which way the ice storm goes, right? But if you're writing to a different crowd, if your audience is a different audience, and you're really doing a lot of the, you know, you're doing a romance novel set in a science fiction genre, you might be able to get away with a lot more of that. So it really kind of depends on, you know, it depends on who your target audience is.
Well, let's take another example. Most people have probably seen Firefly. The original Firefly series, the space setup doesn't make any sense at all. The prologue, the dialogue, the voiceover at the beginning of Serenity actually explains all the geography of space and sets that up before they do the whole thing. And we had a question from it.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I can't see behind it now.
Yeah, one of my things that sometimes is the whole time travel thing, which we could have several panel discussions on. But one of the things I found that, for example, I actually watched the Terminator, the Sarah Connor Chronicles. I enjoyed the show, and I just had to force myself to ignore the fact that if I were Skynet, I would send back 15 copies of myself to different time periods predating the birth of Sarah Connor and do the takeover 100 years earlier and do it all at once so that the other side wouldn't have time to respond.
Yeah, we had a pretty extensive discussion on time travel and its realities about 45 minutes from now and resolved all of it.
The Terminator series has really tried to make it as good as they can.
Yes.
And they actually have a storyline which they did send someone back earlier. And that
they did.
Yeah.
They did.
Back in the 1920s, and the person.
Well, it was an accident, though. He looked up at the clouds, remember?
Right. Yeah. And realized he was in the wrong.
Put himself into a wall.
That's correct. So, the problem with time travel is there are so many permutations that quite quickly it becomes ridiculous. But at least I'm very impressed by the TV series. The TV series is really trying to make sense,
and I am so grateful.
They managed to essentially eliminate Terminator 3 while still keeping it in the continuity.
Yes.
Which is just brilliantly done.
One thing I want to throw in on that too, I think that the Stargate series of shows was very respectful of the time travel problem. Because they did a little bit of time travel in there, but they also showed them messing things up and having to try and fix it and talking about how hard it would be to try and fix it because they could mess it up even worse.
First, well, Johnny and the Bob.
They made it very difficult for time travel as well. Yes. That's one thing that Star Trek should have done.
Yes.
They made it really too easy to time travel, and it's like, oh, we have a problem this season. We have no plot. Well, we'll just time travel.
Right. Fans loved the time travel episodes, too. So
the ones that Star Trek was well done.
The problem is, it's too easy to do. Because essentially, you just have to go really fast around the sun, and that's it.
Or find an alien
artifact. There are two key things to remember when you're writing science fiction, and the science is important. And the first is that sometimes the science needs to be a character. You know, in the story that I've been writing with the, you know, rotating station and the big storm and all that, there were certain physical principles that were important and that the audience had to understand, because the more the audience understands those principles, the more the protagonists are able to leverage those principles to solve their problems. If the audience doesn't understand it and the protagonist uses it, then it feels like Deus Ex Machina. The second thing is that when you're writing science fiction, often you're writing and you're speculating about what if this particular law didn't apply, or if we could circumvent it. Classic example, speed of light. But we've been talking about classic example, linearity of time. What if we could get around this? That's a fun thought experiment, and as long as the ice storm turns the right way, as long as, you know, gravity still works right, yeah, quit patronizing me. as long as you get all the gnats in the right place so that people don't have to strain at them, they will go ahead and swallow the camel. You've got to tell a good story.
Well, because they're willing to do and what if, or explicit what ifs. But you can't be lazy and just make everything a what-if as a way to short-circuit the science fiction to start.
Yeah, what if the main character could travel through time just, like, all by himself? Boom! And like, what was that, Quantum Leap? Mm-hmm. Yes. Essentially do. What if he could do, well, okay, we will swallow that. But the moment he says, and what if he can just magically turn his hand into a dragon? Now, wait a minute, that's secret.
What's the point of the story? What's the point of doing that? I mean, people read science fiction because they like the sense of wonder. And they like the sense of wonder that comes from what-if questions that expand their sense of the possible. And you don't abuse the sense of wonder and the sense of what's possible with lousy logic and lousy unrealistic science fiction things.
The other side of that is, okay, survey question. How many people have ever sat watching a Star Trek episode and screamed at the TV, "Use the transporter!"
Using mine, you can't beam through shields. Stop it.
The transporter is a horrible technology. Because the implications are so profound. It's like, why are you building spaceships anymore? Why don't you just build one and use a duplicator and make your entire fleet?
Big replicator in space.
Exactly.
And then we self-replicating mines. Oh my god, I stopped watching that series right there.
Question in the back.
It made me think of teleportation and the implications of that. It's like the Heisenberg uncertainty principle applies there pretty accurately, and they have a Heisenberg overwriter.
I like how you said the Heisenberg uncertainty principle applies accurately. That was
self-ironic, yeah.
I'm going to show up in an episode of Space Odyssey.
Larry Niven, talking about teleportation, said that as long as you require both a receiver and a transmitter for teleportation, you can tell fun stories that have teleportation in them. The minute you start telling stories in which there is receiverless teleportation, where all you need is a transmitter, you don't need a receiver anywhere, then your story very quickly devolves into a very short, very violent war. Okay? Anytime you have transmitterless teleportation, transmitterless teleportation, you have the rapid, very aggressive transfer of wealth. And you know what? Reading those two principles illustrated to me how broken my universe was when I introduced some new technology, and I had to go back and say, well, you know what? I've just created receiverless teleportation, so it's time for a war. And it worked.
One of the other things that Nimitz says is that when you're writing, every new piece of technology you introduce, every story that takes place after that, the chronology, you have to examine, why does this last piece of technology I introduced not solve every problem in the story? And he talks about how he can't really advance the known space universe anymore because he's got slaver stasis fields, and how come a slaver stasis field doesn't solve every problem in the story? How come the impenetrable holes he introduced a neutron star doesn't solve every problem in this story? And so he's running out of problems that are not solvable, you know, by the technology he has, so he can't introduce anything else.
Well, that's why you create technology like, hey, we found this weird alien artifact and we can't reproduce one of them, and so we can only use it here, and it blew up at the end of the episode!
It is always very helpful to get rid of the magic machine.
And the girlfriend.
Yes.
Or the boyfriend.
Yeah. Exactly.
For the impenetrable hole, you just invent a new technology that actually can penetrate the impenetrable hole.
Yeah. Or when you...
arms race, yeah.
Or I think that I'm a big fan of you introduce the idea of economics and energy costs and energy costs. And by doing that, it makes... Sort of you have some extraordinary technologies, but they're so expensive and so hard to acquire that people have to use other technologies. Because you know what? That's real world. We don't, all of us in here, we do not have access to all the best technologies our civilization has offered because we can't individually afford them.
When we, Brandon, Dan, and I, on the Writing Excuses podcast, talked about magic systems, I came up with the rule of the donkey, which is that if whatever magic thing you do, the work that it does costs less than making the donkey do it, you have to re-examine whatever medieval economic system you have because you've just broken it. And the same holds true for science fiction and fantasy. The real difference is how you explain how the magic works. But that rule of the donkey applies, or the rule of the diesel engine. If it's cheaper than doing it with a diesel engine, what happens to the diesel engine manufacturers? And that's a fun extrapolation. And if you do that right, if you ask that question right and then answer it well, the sense of wonder will be there, and people will say, wow, what a wonderful universe you've created. And hopefully you've populated it with interesting characters.
And if I could point out that to understand a lot of this process, read in the history of science, read in the history of technology, read how the things that actually happened in the past, because we're writing future history. The same rules apply as in the past. You were talking about the cost of doing something. If you look at civilizations that had, like, ancient Chinese or the ancient Romans, and you ask, why didn't they technologically advance? They were so close. Almost invariably, it's because they had cheap labor in the form of either peasants or slaves, and it was always cheaper to use the peasants or slaves than the newfangled machines. The best thing that ever happened to Europe was...
The Black Plague.
The Black Plague.
Because it killed a third of the population and made the cost of labor go up, so that now they were encouraged to say, hey, you know, those windmills could be used more than for decoration.
And you can make the same argument with cotton gin and the Civil War.
One other comment on the recording of questions. There's a show they did in the 70s that was just, it was great fun to watch, called Connections.
Yeah.
They would trace how, one of our modern day inventions, they traced back exactly how it got there. And the episode I loved the best was the one where they proved that the computer was invented because of the demand for more comfortable underwear.
When I'm sitting in front of my computer wearing nothing but my underwear,
you're so brave.
You should. I took you there and you went willingly.
Some of them are very willing.
here, please. Get us away from the
thing. Oh, just not such a question. Just a note that popped in my mind a long time ago. I read Isaac Asimov's The Gods Themselves, which isn't one of his best books, but he took that economic view and just ran with it. The whole story of The Gods Themselves is humankind finds cheap energy. The downside is it'll destroy the sun in a few years. But it's so cheap, you know, that you just have to have it. It's just such a great deal. And you can build off of that alone, you know.
That's how our financial crisis got started.
What if we go to the Black Friday?
My most recent story in analog involves molecular duplication of things. And, you know, well, if you can duplicate stuff at the molecular level, then manufacturing all sorts of stuff becomes very easy. And so I had laws put in place regulating what patterns can be reproduced, et cetera, in order to have a world that still recognizably ours with economics similar to ours. And you know, the question in the story is, what's the difference between a nano-replicated Stradivarius violin and the original? So, but yeah, when you've got technology, sometimes the solution to, you know, the story solution is to have laws or other social interactions.
As long as you're internally consistent with the restrictions and your, the way things are implied, I think the reader is going to follow an awful lot. But it has to be internally consistent.
I can't remember who said it, but they said, explain, take something really, really small and fairly insignificant and explain the heck out of it, and then take something big and don't explain it at all. And again, it comes back to that, you know, straining at gnats and swallowing camels. If you've explained the gnat really well, then when you introduce the camel, that goes down.
It's because you've created a sense of confidence in the writer.
Yeah.
And that's what you want.
Show yourself to be a good liar.
We understand it's a false sense of confidence, but still, you do. There are certain writers, you believe that they've worked through this in your mind, and you're going to trust them. And then there's other writers that you believe are lazy and you don't want to read them.
Or 2D3.
Yes. Our guest of honor, Tracy Hickman, has a quote, I believe it was him, who said, you're allowed one unexplained thing in the story. People ask him about dragons. He said, that's my one unexplained thing. How can... my one unexplained thing.
I think that goes back to, I think it was Theodore Sturgeon's idea that he would only have one thing different in the story. That's how he would center his story around that one difference.
Was it the same Sturgeon who said 90% of everything is crap?
Yeah, but he was referring to his own collection of work.
When you apply that to the internet, he was like a blatant optimist.
Sturgeon is very respected. Don't try to sway you from reading some of this stuff.
At least 10%.
Any more questions?
When does it matter when you've got bad science fiction, and dare I call Star Trek Next Generation bad science fiction? It's bad science, certainly. But if the populace is buying it, when does
cash the checks?
Okay. How much does it matter?
I think there's a matter of self-respect.
Cash the check.
I'm with Howard on this one.
I thought that Next Generation was good science. They did have to avoid some things because the transport technology just blew everything out of the water. And they couldn't do anything about that.
I hated Next Generation.
Reverse the polarity.
Well, Next Generation, it had something classic. I mean, they had the classic Niven mistake where they said they came up with a transporter that could transport through shields. Not that they couldn't transport through shields whenever they wanted to. But they'd have they'd even say you can't transport through shields without the show them doing it. But they had a little device, but it messed up your DNA, so you couldn't use it. Only the terrorists would use it. I'm like, there are thousands of military applications for being able to transport through any defense without doing it to a human, like, you know, a bomb.
A robot carrying bombs.
Rottweilers. You can transport trained Rottweilers.
Yeah.
question in the back?
Yeah, I have a question more from somebody who enjoys science fiction more than wants to write it or something. What do you do when the people that you, you know, share science fiction with, family members, significant others like that, are the type of people that will swallow the gnat no matter how well it is described?
Smile and nod. I mean, if these are people you're married to, smile and nod a lot.
Or you can be the person that's always spoiling the story for them.
So reciprocate, you're saying.
This is why when I go to movies that I know are going to be really bad movies, I don't take my wife, I take Bob. Bob and I have a great time at these films. Sandra and I, well actually Sandra's really, really bright too. She just doesn't want to go into that theater to begin with.
Because they don't dare throw Bob out.
Question to people who are interested in writing science fiction. When in your universe is it okay to pull the, oh, and it turns out that it can also do this trick?
Your readers to hate you. You have to lay the groundwork to make it believable before you can do
it. Readers don't want to be tricked. And it has to advance the plot. It has to advance the plot in a reasonable way. And it has to pass the donkey test of, okay, is that the most rational way to solve that problem? I mean, people, as much as people hate knowing what the outcome is going to be from 5 minutes into the movie, they hate even worse not knowing what the outcome is going to be and being totally shocked at the outcome and going, wait, no, that's not right.
It's not that they hate when the outcome isn't what they expected. Okay, there's the law that I like to cite. Beginning of Serenity, or Beginning of Firefly with the dinosaurs. Curse you and your... surprising yet inevitable. That's what I was talking about. Surprising yet inevitable. Inevitable means the forces that you've put to play in this story are inevitably leading to this conclusion. There is no other way it could wind up. But it can still be surprising. The problem comes in when it's surprising yet deus ex machina, or surprising yet did you forget that they can transport through shields? You know, that's when it's broken.
Or the murder mystery when at the very end, oh, by the way, this person did it, this is why, we just didn't tell you the clues are in the whole book. That's just a cheap shot to the reader, and readers hate that.
Just as a reader, I guess the other thing that I hate is when it's really obvious that it could also do that all along, but somehow our hero is the only one who could figure that out, even though it's as plain as the nose on your face to all of humanity who's reading the book, and that, you know, that doesn't...
So you want to be as smart as the hero, but you don't want to be smart.
I don't want the hero to be the only human being in the universe who can get dressed without help.
There's a fine line there. Because for the most part, people like figuring it out just before the hero, like 10 pages before, 20 pages before. It's just not like the whole book.
What's fun, and the way to handle that is with perspective switching. You introduce the situation in which the hero now has all the pieces in front of him, but hasn't figured it out, and then you switch to another character, and that gives the reader time to say, oh, I'm smarter than he is, now I've got it, and then the hero figures it out. But I see what you're saying. You're saying, why can't everybody have figured this out?
Well, I hate it when you have, for example, an entire corporate culture that created this invention, it does X, Y, and Z, and you need it to do A, and it does A, and the hero can see that, and you can see that. The hero has no access to any of the company's records. So the whole company is astounded. Yeah. Doesn't believe it, has never noticed.
How many of you work for large companies, or have worked for large companies? I have seen sick corporate culture where there is institutional blindness, and that is a...
When it's done as a feature of bureaucratic red tape, that works. When it's done as a feature of general human stupidity, it doesn't.
It's back to the whole thing of stare at the TV and scream, use the transporter, moron!
We have a question back here. Go for it.
Do you think it just basically comes down to
in science fiction is a genre where we expect, where we, the laws of causality, like cause and effect, are a lot more central to the story than anything, than any other genre.
Well, I think they're pretty important in this.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But, no, I agree.
Pretty important in romances. It's just that
male
is not supposed to understand the cause.
Yeah, what about the comment about the mystery that's solved using information were provided for, reminded me of an episode of Perrault where Perrault solved a mystery in a play, but it was wrong because he didn't have all the information.
Yeah, and that can be an interesting plot piece that you solved the problem and then figure out you solved it wrong because there's some other puzzle piece that you haven't seen. That can be an excellent plot piece.
Well, that's how they discovered
we have someone on the lower level down here.
Sorry,
those of you in the peanut gallery may now speak.
Woo! In an example of think about your world building people, I really, really like Doctor Who. However, I have serious issues with the premise of the new series, which is the main character is a time traveler. His entire race is a race of time travelers. His entire race was wiped out by a gigantic war and there's nobody else left. And I'm the only one who sees the problem with this.
Well, it was a time war between time travelers.
I had a problem until Eric said this to me.
And essentially, you know, you've got time travelers going back and somehow managing to cancel out at least one of the races. If you look at it as a war specifically designed to wipe out someone from the timeline, then the fact that they could time travel doesn't necessarily mean they could escape it if they were somehow.
Okay. They've never explained it in Doctor Who, and I expect them to, because they're doing a really good job of writing that series. The way I look at it, imagine you just nuked a city to glass. Okay? It's now radioactive and toxic and whatever else, and it's gone. Okay? Now imagine doing that with time energy to the point that it's always never existed.
Like I say, I love the show.
The end of season 4, they explain it that the time warp is time walk. They can't time travel back into it.
They did not explain it. They used one word.
Yes.
And we explain it with tiny whiny whatever.
When we receive information, we try to organize it, and all it takes is one clue like that time lock, and we're like, oh, I know what a lock means. That means you can't change things, or you can't open something. And everyone actually has a different idea if they started talking about it, what that actually means, but it's good enough to create that, maintain that internal world, maintain that credibility.
Don't explain if you don't have to.
Or use an explanation that doesn't actually explain. Right, that's right.
There's a hand in there.
We have a hand back here first.
I've been really fascinated with Frank Herbert's Dune. It's an amazing book, amazing whole series of books, absolutely. But what I wonder is, how political is too political in a sci-fi novel?
How dated do you want your story?
I would say there's nothing wrong with good politics in the story. Don't make it equivalent to politics today.
Have any of you ever read Bio of a Space Tyrant by Piers Anthony? Have any of you ever read that? And Jupiter equals America, and Mars equals Mexico, and Saturn equals Russia, and that book is so dead and so completely not worth reading now because he wasn't writing political intrigue, he was writing political satire, and the situation that spawned the satire ceased to exist. So why read the book? Yeah.
I just want to say this. The the Satan's Angel was supposed to, Douglas Adams addressed this in the Time Lord thing in his series of books as well, with the 10 things of real time, and talking about how they built this factory backwards until something didn't exist anymore, and so, you know, all this, that kind of thing. So that's something that's fun to parody as well.
Well, I'll give a good example. V for Vendetta, which was considered by many to be a very revolutionary graphic novel, for me is almost completely unreadable because it's so much about Thatch writing. And when they translated it into the movie did not resonate with viewers because that political situation no longer existed. It would have been appropriate in the mid-80s or even the late 80s. It didn't make sense. There was no resonance from that on, and it failed. It's a movie because of that.
Well, you might watch some of the classic Star Trek episodes. There are some of them that are just duds now because they were all about a social situation of the time that no longer exists. Like a lot of ones about the women's rights and, you know, female doing this thing, and it's, oh, women are doing this, but, and now it's like, why can't you deal?
So,
40 years makes a huge difference. There are other classic Star Trek episodes that still resonate with viewers today. I use them, you know, teaching my kids, and if I were teaching students in high school, I'd be showing them these classic episodes because they bring up these issues that are still very relevant. So when you're writing about politics and the realities of that, people are still going to be people, but the situation is going to change. So keep that in mind
if you're writing. Yeah. When I write, if I'm going to do politics, I want to write political intrigue. You know, I'll write.
Timeless.
Yeah, intrigue is fun. Intrigue is fun. Lampooning the Republicans or the Democrats or whatever can also be fun as long as you're doing it in such a way that it works, even if it's not Republicans or Democrats. You know, you want it to be, you want it to be just a little bit broader. Unless what you're writing is a pointedly, very timely op-ed piece disguised as a science fiction story, in which case, more power to you. It needs to be published in the next 6 months, and then you're done with it.
Have you ever read *Built with Electric Girl* by Harry Harrison?
Yes.
Great political satire, but very timeless as well. It's hysterical.
That's the reason that Dilbert works, right? Dilbert works not because it points at a particular company or even a particular industry. It points at stupid management decisions, and it doesn't matter what the stupid management decisions are. It's a timeless cartoon because of that.
I was going to say, but if you do politics, a couple of things. You can do politics, you can have your own point of view, you can even be evangelical about trying to convince people to your point of view. But you have to be honest with them about from the beginning about what you're doing. You don't lead them into it, pretend to be doing something else and saying, oh, by the way, I'm going to secretly sneak this stuff in here and convert you to my point of view. But people see that and it's like, this is so much crap.
I completely agree with you, except for one exception. Robert Heinlein, who is the only writer in history to get away with it. Mm-hmm. We loved Robert Heinlein. I loved Robert Heinlein as a kid. I'm a little less tolerant now. I'm a little more mature. But it's his books are political polemics, and it worked. But the rest of us are back there.
And they don't necessarily work now.
No.
Okay, my question isn't quite sci-fi, but it's close enough. I think I can get away with it.
Is it real?
No, it's not real. That's why I think I can get away with it. Okay, and going back kind of to the one unexplained thing, someone mentioned dragons. Okay, with dragons, I think you get a couple unexplained things. They're huge, and they can actually fly. Their wings are actually strong enough, but they're so little. They can breathe fire, yet they don't burn themselves. And one of my questions I really want to focus on is a lot of stories of dragons have dragon riders, and like Dragon Riders of Pern, Tracy Hickman and Margaret Weiss do the dragon lance that have a reason they have lances. But in these stories, why do dragons need riders? Because they can breathe fire, they can talk, they can do magic. What purpose does it have for them to have someone on their back?
Well, in the good stories, they explain that. For instance, in Dragon Riders of Pern, they're psychically connected to their rider, and they're bonded.
I know, but why?
Because why are they bonded? Well, that's...
Maybe I can get that part into a series.
I got this one. It's because you, the reader, we, the readers, are going to identify with the human characters, not with the dragons, and the thought of riding one of them things into battle thrills us. And so the author says, I want to write something with sense of wonder in it. I want to write something where people just cheer about, you know, woohoo, I'm riding a dragon. And that was Dragon Riders Burn, Dragonlance, and Aragon, and
Olympus.
You just have to have the reason that the people can buy it. As I said, Dragon Riders Burn, they're psychically linked. The dragon doesn't, I mean, they're bonded. They're like the same person. I wrote a story once where it was a bad story, so no. But it was all political. The dragon was allowed to have legal authority, but the rider was, and they had legal duties to do, and like, you know, patrols and hunting out bandits and stuff. So the dragon was not allowed to do that without a rider present, because he had, you know, law enforcement authority. But it was a bad story. But the explanation made sense from a political standpoint. So, you know, you have to, if you want to give these great wish fulfillment things that don't make sense, you just have to give the reader something to
help along. This is one point where being female works better here, because dragon stories are just glorified horse stories.
Yes.
There's something about girls and horses where we just have this mystical idea, you know, girls
horses
well,
can breathe fire.
Girls always have this thing where I want to have this horse and we're going to have this mystical relationship and, you know, we're going to be psychically linked and it's going to be just wonderful, and horses are just so wonderful and stage girls go through it. I mean, you know, dragons are just kind of, you know, the guy version of the horse story. That's why you have to have writers.
So we keep on talking about realism in terms of science and technology. But when you talk about dragons, the most popular recent dragon story is that series by
Naomi Novik.
And I read the first one. I thought, you know, I really like this. And then they have the big battle scene where, you know, Napoleon's dragon troops are coming across and they're carrying the troops. And then they have this big battle, and then the French give up and go home. And I was going,
well, that's very realistic.
From a military history, from a military standpoint, she lost me right there. It was, what she did is she wrote herself into a corner, or she had no clue about how military operations actually work, and she...
She was just thinking French. She forgot that.
That's the first rule of French military. Invasion. Invasions are suicide missions. You keep on going. You don't quit every time. People die and go home.
The first rule of French military is that they can always win a battle.
It's so fancy.
Okay, my question is, how do you know when you're writing a net? How do I know if it's something that I actually have to explain?
The only way to know that is to ask. If you can't see it yourself, that's what writers' groups are for. Send it out and see what you get back. If you get back 1 3-page explanation and everybody else is okay with it, don't sweat it.
Let me ask
8 3-page explanations, probably something you need to pay attention to.
Let me ask this. Do you subscribe to any sort of science periodicals or read that sort of stuff?
No.
Because if you don't, you're not gonna recognize it. I mean, if you're writing a story about weather control, we can make it rain whenever, it would really be good if you already understand the water cycle. because it's gonna come up. So subscribing to science periodicals, super helpful. There's lots of websites with RSS feeds nowadays that will give you those sorts of things. And just reading them and following some of the hyperlinks will broaden your mind to the point that you can see the gnats.
I really recommend New Scientist.
That's what I was going to recommend.
It's out of England. Scientific American, yeah, we all know and love it, but everyone has to admit that very few people can read all the articles and know what they're talking about.
What about Wikipedia?
Right, but New Scientist is more like a college level. Yet they also have speculative articles, and they have a very broad-based article.
New Scientist likes to go on the fringes of science, and so
for writing science fiction, that sparks a lot of ideas.
So we just answered your question. We just answered your question by saying research. Sorry.
It works.
Okay, we have one more comment up here, and then we've got closing remarks.
I was just going to say, I don't know if it was actually in the Dragon Riders of Fern, but because I'm questioning that because of the answer when that came up. But my understanding that maybe I just developed on my own to make my version of why it worked, because I wanted to believe, was that the writer was necessary because that gave more another pair of eyes to help find what needed to be, or the thread that needed to be charged.
That's true. And Dragon Riders also, if I remember correctly, the dragons can't travel between anymore without a rider.
They do.
Can they? Yeah. Can they? Well, I remember there was a thing about the rider had to picture it.
The dragons
generally, if the dragon went between without its rider, it got stuck. There were couple of exceptions, but
that was they didn't have a clear idea.
Yeah.
They had
their
questions.
They were like
totally
cold. They could
get
it.
Well, what about Wikipedia? What about Wikipedia for research? I mean, if you use Wikipedia for your science, is that enough?
Talk to me afterwards.
Okay.
I mean, I can spend. I'm serious. I'm not anti-Wikipedia, but we can have a very interesting conversation.
Okay.
Wikipedia is a fantastic place to start.
Yes.
But don't trust everything you read there.
Follow the references.
That's great.
Any closing remarks from our panel?
I have a free audiobook out at playtesting.net. Playtesting.net. It has nothing to do with this. It's a very realistic depiction of what happens when stupid people design a world.
It's awesome.
I've been listening to Bob's podcast, playtesting.net, and it is one of my favorite things in the whole world to listen to. Other than. No. Other than. I'm getting to my own plug here. And other than the sound of my own voice, writingexcuses.com, where we do a podcast about writing, and we talk about things like this 15 minutes long because you're in a hurry and you're not that smart.
just remember when you're writing this stuff, explain only as much as you have to. That way you don't get tripped up in the details too much. And research matters. It really does. If you want to do things without research, go write something.
Is there at least a research is possible?
I have to follow that.
Sorry.
You couldn't have waited. I have to follow that. I think the biggest thing you can do, just like Eric said, is do your research. Know what it is that you're writing about. You've got to know. Yeah, sorry. I should have been more specific in my Eric comment. Sorry. Know what you've got to know the subject matter that you're writing about, or you've got to go learn about it, or you've got to find the right audience that isn't going to care. If you're writing stuff that you look at and go, that makes absolutely no sense. How come lead majors can pick up that car, because that should just tear his arm right off? You need to explain that. You need to help people understand. How that works or why that works. That's right. For $16 million, you could be able to pick up a car, dang it!
Okay, since we're doing blatant plugs, I'm published in this magazine. But it's not fiction. It's, if you're interested, here we go. Mine is that. Temple of Doom dinner for 12 to 14 people. I did the rest. I have a red ball piece coming out.
Do you need bugs?
No, I have my own collection of bugs.
No, I mean for the recipes. Do you need bugs?
There are some big beetles. But they're not real beetles.
Okay. She's good at that kind of thing.
All right.
Well, thank you for being on.